Hey, this is Alex Hyde-White. Stay tuned, because I'm the next guest on Screen and Beyond.
On Screen and Beyond, an inside look into the entertainment world featuring interviews with people from the movie, TV, and music industry, news on upcoming TV and DVD releases, and the rumor mill. And now, here's the host of On Screen and Beyond, Brian Zemrak.
We're back for another edition of On Screen and Beyond. This is episode 662 of the show that keeps you updated on what's coming your way as far as upcoming new movies, remakes, sequels, and TV and movie DVD releases, as well as our interview segment with a guest from the movie, TV, or music industry. This week on Screen and Beyond, Alex Hyde-White joins us here on Screen and Beyond. He was in Pretty Woman, Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade, Battlestar Galactica, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, The Toy, whole lots of stuff. And we're going to talk about a lot of those things right here with Alex Hyde-White joining us at On Screen and Beyond. Well, it is starting to cool down. I don't know where you are, but, where I am, it's starting to get a little bit cooler. Put a few logs in the wood stove there to get things going. And it's almost Thanksgiving, so want to wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving if you're in the United States. Everywhere else, glad to have you with us, and I hope you're going to enjoy this episode of On Screen and Beyond. And if you have a suggestion, want to talk to me, whatever, send me an email at feedback@onscreenandbeyond.com. I love hearing from you. Love hearing your suggestions, and you go ahead and connect with me there. Or, of course, we're on, the socials, and you can DM me there. I'm not as good as on those. I don't answer those as much. Sometimes I can't get to them, or I'm just busy and trying to get the shows out and get guests here on Screen and Beyond. So I get to those later, but the feedback is probably the best place to get in touch with me. So if you want to do that, that's fine. And also on onscreenandbeyond.com, you can get merchandise from On Screen and Beyond. You can get t-shirts and sweatshirts and hats and all that stuff. It's all there. Be sure to check it out. Go to our button on the top. And I got to add another one here somewhere, little explanation of it. But also, anyways, up at the top, it says On Screen and Beyond merchandise. It brings you to the website where you can get all that stuff. And they're pretty quick getting that stuff out. So you can still have time to, find out what you want, or you're giving to somebody, or you want somebody to give to you, whatever. Makes a great gift for the holidays coming up, so you can check that out at onscreenandbeyond.com. And we've got a lot of things coming. I'm looking here at the list of different stuff. This episode of On Screen and Beyond is going to be telling you about November and December releases. I didn't do a fall release episode like we usually do, but we're going to tell you what's coming your way in November and December as far as releases. So why don't we get right into that? All right. It's time for remakes, sequels, and prequels coming your way in November and December right here on Screen and Beyond.
Please hang up and try
again. Remakes, sequels, and prequels. Well, The Hunger Games, The Ballad of the Songbird and Snakes flies into theaters on November 17th. Also on November 17th, Trolls Band Together will be coming our way. December 15th, Wonka continues the telling of Willy Wonka's story. Aquaman and the Last Kingdom swims our way on December 20th. And December 25th, Christmas Day, The Color Purple gets remade. And that's it for remakes, sequels, and prequels coming your way in November and December as far as releases coming your way. Now let's find out what's coming your way as upcoming new movies in November and December right here on Screen and Beyond. Upcoming new movies, Napoleon tells the story of the Emperor Napoleon on November 22nd. Also on November 22nd, Disney's Wish will be arriving. Migration, the animated film, flaps its wings into theaters on December 22nd, and on December 25th, Ferrari races into theaters. That's it for upcoming new movies coming your way in November and December. Next on Screen and Beyond, well, why don't we find out what's coming your way as far as movies and TV on DVD and streaming. Oh. Movies and TV on DVD and streaming. Sound of Freedom goes DVD and Blu-ray on November 14th. Expendables explodes on 4K, Blu-ray, and DVD on November 21st. And A Haunting in Venice lands on DVD and Blu-ray on November 28th. Also on November 28th, Ancient Aliens Season 18 arrives on DVD. And WandaVision Season 1 goes 4K and Blu-ray on November 28th. That's it for movies and TV on DVD and streaming. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, it's TV and Entertainment time. TV and Entertainment time, and Letterkenny will end with season 14 on Hulu. All six episodes will drop on December 26th. And Prison Break may return with new shows on Hulu, as it is in the early development stage, with it being written and executive produced by the Mayans co-creator. So they're going to bring it back. And Euphoria will return for a third season in 2025. That's it for TV and Entertainment time. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, we're sitting down with Alex Hyde-White. And he was in Pretty Woman. He was in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Battlestar Galactica, whole bunch of stuff. We're going to talk about all that in his career. Alex Hyde-White next, right here on Screen and Beyond. Our guest today on Screen and Beyond has acted in the blockbusters Pretty Woman and Indiana Jones and Last Crusade. We have seen him on Battlestar Galactica, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, The Toy, Matlock, Murder, She Wrote, Babylon 5, NCIS, Bones, Shameless, This Is Us, and so much more. It's Alex Hyde-White. Alex, welcome to On Screen and Beyond.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Alex, looking at your career here, you've done a lot of stuff. And it was funny because the other day I was watching the Pretty Woman and then I saw you. And that's when that's what triggered me to turn around and send you a request to see if you'd do the interview.
Yeah, it's a big hit. You know, I was in the business 10 years. And Gene Hackman always said the secret to success was the second 10 years.
Really?
And that movie, yeah, that was, you said that on the Merv Griffin show once. That's a great quote. And anyway, so I'd been doing it. And then that movie hit. And I said, okay, that's a good one. And to this day, it just keeps getting better and better. It's an example of wonderful casting.
Yeah.
And great direction, and they got it right on that, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now, take us back to when you were just a little kid. Of course, your father was in the business, so you know, I'm sure that had something to do with it. But what led you to decide to do this for a career?
You know, I was a precocious kid. They skipped me a couple of grades down in Palm Springs growing up. So I was 16 years old when I got out of high school, and I got into Georgetown University and froze my butt off in -3 degrees weather coming from Palm Springs. And so I lasted about a year there. Such a good school. I learned everything I needed to know in 1 year and left. And, you know, I liked Washington. My dad had played Washington a couple of years before then in the early 70s in a play, and you know, I liked the, it was exciting. But then I realized when I was back in Southern Cal, you know, it was very similar vibe to showbiz, the adrenaline, the you know, sort of campaigns and candidates. It's auditions and jobs. And so it was very similar skill set. And never went back to college and took a few classes here and there. And then I was lucky that Battlestar Galactica was hiring lads to fly jets in space, and so I was one of their last contract players in 1978 to 80. I was a contract player at Universal. Mm-hmm. And that's when I got in a lot of those early shows, and that got me started. And you know, I'd grown up backstage, and so it's kind of like, you know, how did you get into gun running? Well, you know, my dad was an arms dealer, or you know.
Yeah.
You know, what made you go into politics? My dad was a governor, you know. Mm-hmm. So you do that. I mean, a lot of kids don't want to do what the family business, and I didn't for a while, but I enjoyed it, and I'd been around it enough backstage. I was comfortable with actors of all shapes and sizes, creeds, colors, orientations, all that nonsense that's supposed to make a difference. And the great thing about theater, it's kind of like the circus. You know, everybody is a little off. Everybody is a little eccentric. Mm-hmm. And so I found that I fit well. And then it's just a matter of opportunity. And Universal gave me the opportunity to get started. And like I say, 10 years later, Pretty Woman hit. And that kind of said, okay, I can stay now, you know. Yeah, you know, I've been trying to find something else to do ever since. But, you know, when you're a young actor, it helps if you work in a restaurant or if you're a cab driver or if you're a car parking or something, because you need to get around and you need to eat. So
yeah, yeah.
You need to be self-sufficient.
What was it like being I think Universal, or not just Universal, but Hollywood itself was just at the ending of the contract players. Is that correct?
Yeah, they were all over. Universal was the last because the people who ran it, Eleanor Kilgallen in New York and great old former agent named Monique James, they had started MCA with Jules Stein, who were booking bands back in the 40s probably. And they'd been around a long time. And so he had a loyalty to them. And, you know, they had a lot of people. Even our time, we had Sharon Gless, who was working. Lindsay Wagner was the Bionic Woman. And then, of course, wonderful Jamie Lee Curtis was 20 years old. She was pretty much my age. And she hit the Halloween movie that came while she was a contract player. I said, okay, I just spoke to her a couple months ago and we were reminiscing because I wrote my book. Is out now. It's my memoirs of 40 years. And of course, yeah. It starts pretty much with those on the studio, on the lot days at Universal, which was fun.
Yeah.
78 to the early 80s. Yeah. Yeah.
So as far as your book, what does that span? Does it start at a certain age or is it your whole life in general? Or?
Well, you know, it's my life in film and TV. I call it In the Volume, which is a very modern term used for digital filmmaking. Instead of being, you know, in the frame or on film, you're now in the volume. You capture the digital space. And it's a wonderful analogy that sort of has one foot in old-fashioned analog filmmaking, mm-hmm. but is a modern term because basically, you know, they say if you're not in the shot, you know, get out of the volume because they need the gigabyte space. So that appealed to me. And so I feel like my whole life I've been living in the volume. And I was able to go through my credits. Fortunately, IMDb has most of them listed. And so I was able to remind myself of sort of the where and when. And once I did that, I was able to amass and tap into pretty darn good recall because, you know, it's been exciting. I mean, I've worked with some wonderful, wonderful people, peak experiences. And so those things are indelible, you know, in my memory, and they last a lot longer than the failures. The failures are expected, you know. Mm-hmm. You miss in anything. You miss far more than you hit, and I was able to go back in a way and take inventory. It's like going through storage. It was a wonderful experience. I started it a year before the COVID shutdown, of course, and then the lockdown gave me more time. I find a lot of people, a lot of celebrities, a lot of actors are mm-hmm. releasing their memoirs now. And mine's a little different because I'm not really known for one thing. It's not like the guy from Friends or,
yep.
you know, the brother of the king of the future king of England, you know.
Yeah.
I might not be known really for anything, but it's almost like a Forrest Gump. It's a time travel tour through most of the 80s and 90s up to modern day of my point of view of the world through the lens of film and TV acting. And so I've been very fortunate to be in some wonderful situations, you know, like being on the deck of the USS John F. Kennedy aircraft carrier night landings when we were filming Top Gun for TV back in 89. It was called Super Carrier. And being in Morocco with Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman and Elaine May and a wonderful boondoggle called Ishtar, and
yes,
Spielberg
that.
And, yeah. and young Henry Jones with the great River Phoenix, God bless him. You know, so I've drawn an inside straight so many times in my life that I basically had to put it down on paper because it's hard to believe. I've been incredibly fortunate. I have not amassed a fortune. I'm rich like Brabantio says about Juliet. No, Romeo says about Juliet. She's rich in beauty, only poor that when she dies with beauty dies her store. You know, I'm living, fortunately, a rich and varied life, and I'm not afraid to embrace the ups and downs. And so it was a great experience. And the people who've read it and the feedback is wonderful because it's not a celebrity tell-all. It's not just a celebration of the jobs I've got. It's a through line of a guy or a person who became an actor and was able to live this extremely rare life. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody, you know, but people are interested in that, I think.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. And now where can people get the book?
Oh, it's Amazon, you know, in the volume it's called. It's easy. I'm easy to find. I mean, there's nobody else with an A and an X and a hyphen in their name, at least not that I know of.
Yeah.
Hi, Michael Dorn, Worf, Star Trek The Next Generation, On Screen and Beyond.
Now, being the son of Wilfred Hyde White, was that tough as a kid? You know, sometimes it's tough, you know, if your brother or your father or your mother or whatever. Was it tough to grow up?
No. You know, he was easy to get along with. You just had to allow him to be eccentric. You know, he was born in 1903 and I was born in 1959. So he was 55, 56 years old. My mother was almost 30 years younger, and she lasted about 15 years. He scared the hell out of her, and so she left. So, you know, it's a fairly common story, except for the fact that my dad actually did have touches of brilliance throughout his life, because in his work, and the one thing I learned very, very early on, probably around 11, 12 years old, he and a couple of his mercurial friends, none more mercurial than the great Peter Sellers, they had this tremendous ability to be on, and then when they were off, they'd get very depressed. I don't know if it was manic depressive or I don't know what it is. It's just, you know, you have to live through that. And, you know, it sort of undercuts what should be a joy of living. And I think it was hard. It was hard on my mom, but it instilled in me this value of humanity, this sort of joy of experience, which I've been able to put down, not to just live at the mercy of the highs and lows. And that was the greatest lesson that I learned growing up as a successful actor's son. Now, mind you, he was a well-known actor at that time in England. Yes, he was fairly well-known in America and continues to be. But it's not like I'm not like Jason Connery growing up in England as Sean Connery.
Exactly, so, you
know,
yeah.
Who I knew at a very young age. And, you know, Jason's a nice fellow. He's become a good director.
Yeah, he's been a guest here.
Oh, has he?
Yes, quite a few years ago, but Jason
was on.
Oh,
how lovely. Yeah. How lovely. Yeah, yeah. He had a lot of pressure on him, you know.
Oh, I'm
and
sure.
That's why I left England. I started my career after Universal ended in, what, 81, and I go to New York, I do a play. 83, I'm in England. Kind of broke, but I was a client of the William Morris Agency because on a play in New York, an old William Morris agent signed me, which was too big an agency for a young actor. But over in England, they were a smaller agency, and I could play Americans. And so they really did well. I did well with them in 83, 84, 85.
Wow.
And got myself some nice credits and some great experience, almost like playing in the Pensacola Blue Wahoos before getting sent up to the Miami Marlins or something, you know?
Yeah.
And it was great experience. But I knew I wasn't going to live there because there was an expectation. And England is a very small, London's a very small society, very, very rare for the son of somebody not just famous, but almost notorious to carve out his own existence. And so, and plus, I by that time, I, hold on.
somebody, I think it's Arnold Schwarzenegger flying over.
Sounded close.
Yeah, I know, huh? Yeah. I'm still on the deck of the aircraft carrier. No, you know, but by that time, I had some roots in Southern Cal, and I just knew I wanted to live there. And then my first son was born in 1990. Before you know it, it's 2003 or 2004, and I was saying, whoa, I've been at this since 1980. And that's when I started producing. And I made a couple movies. And then in 2011, I started audiobook narrating. And I've created this company called Punch Audio. It's in 10 years, has grown. It does a lot of audiobook production for independent authors the world over. And so I was able to sort of marry my love of producing and hiring people and creating. And that's what the modern actor has to do. I mean, there isn't a successful actor that we know, whether it's Bradley Cooper or who isn't either creating content or directing it. And so I've been fortunate to do that as an audiobook producer as well. And that's something that my dad didn't need to do, and he would never have done. I mean, he was an actor. Like most of these older generations of the, you know, up till the 60s, they were actors, and they either worked or they didn't. Yeah. And the trouble is, what do you do when you're not working? And, you know, that's it's always been dangerous. But these days, you know, you can drive Lyft.
Yeah. Now, you've mentioned throughout the conversation here some very big name, Peter Sellers and different. Now, growing up, were you exposed to a lot of, you know, really famous people like the Peter Sellers and whoever else?
Well, I mean, I think the extent of my name dropping doesn't get much higher than Peter. Not so much younger. You know, my dad was a kind of actor who was at his best when he was a sort of an actor manager, when he would help cast a show and do these shows. So it would be the people that would work with him that I got to know, wonderful character actors. But later in, when I started my own career, I just found myself, perhaps I think because I was hireable, because I had an understanding of the humanity of actors, I was certainly not starstruck. I find in a way that I kind of feel most comfortable when I'm on a big movie set. Sometimes it's the lousy movies or the other TV shows that I would get, you know, just, you know, get insecure about, but it's weird. So it's an interesting question you pose, but I think the answer is that really the famous folks that we would know and recognize today, you know, I kind of did that just as throughout the course of my career. No, you know, no, I think there was no one more famous than Sellers when I was younger. Yeah.
Well, that's,
you know, and then, I mean, Dustin Hoffman is an American when he was at his peak, is an American equivalent, I think, of Sellers, his chameleon-like ability. But, you know, Dustin's obviously a wonderful dramatic actor, whereas Sellers was equally adept at, you know, Dr. Strangelove and Chauncey Gardner and Being There. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah.
There was just a sympathy with Sellers that he had charisma. I think Richard Gere had charisma in Pretty Woman and other things. Travolta in his early films had charisma.
Right.
And that's something that's very, very hard to come by. It's like when you walk in a room, not that everybody looks at you, the room changes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is an indescribable. You have to see it to believe it. And that's been there. River Phoenix, I think, had it in him. He had a wonderful internal life, a way of you wanted to sympathize with him.
Now, what was your experience of working with Steven Spielberg, Indiana Jones, and Last Crusade? You know, you're working with on a series of movies that is just humongous. How was it working it on that?
Well, Steven was wonderful. It was the first time I'd met him was up in Alamosa, Colorado, when we were, you know, they were setting that shot up, and it was a wonderful scene right in the beginning of the movie, which sort of centers on the mailbox that says Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And then you move inside, and there's a fellow sitting at a desk, and he says, oh, draw, draw, you know, and it was a very difficult part for him to cast. But it was real easy when it came time to film it. I've worked with him now 3 times. What I say about Stephen is kind of what I say about Jordan Peele now a little bit, having been on with him on Nope for a few days a couple of years ago when that movie was being made. He's one of the very rare directors who you feel that he completely trusts you because he's cast you, and you can do no wrong. And that's a great feeling. It's the reality is that they're going to edit the film anyway, and they're going to film what they need, and they're going to get this scene. So if you happen to do something original or something that requires a bit of confidence, then they're so pleased. A lot of actors, when they get around people who they admire or people who are supposed to be famous or the best at their job, they get reticent, not so much insecure, but they get cautious because they don't want to make a mistake. And Stephen and Jordan, and to a sense, Gary Marshall, empower their actors. And as a result, there are occasional brilliant moments that happen. I mean, look at Christopher Walken again. So the second time I played the divorce lawyer in Catch Me If You Can, a character named Dick Kesner. And I get to yell at, what's his name? Leo. And Leonardo DiCaprio was playing the same age and almost looked like River Phoenix did 11, 12 years prior. True. As young Indiana Jones, right? It was surreal. Mm-hmm. And Stephen was the commonality, the element in common for both. I mean, and so when I say to Leonardo, hey, calm down, I'm Dick Kesner, now come on into the other room, your parents want to see you, and then I scare him into signing the document of just where do you want to live, your mother or your father, and it scares the crap out of him. Of course, what does he do? He runs away. So when they cast me for that, they'd added this scene for Catch Me If You Can. I'd originally been up for the Martin Sheen role, which was, I think, earlier in the film, his girlfriend's father. And I guess Martin Sheen needed a job for a change. And so they gave it to him. It's great. I'm not going to lose work to Martin Sheen. My gosh.
Right.
So the word came down, hey, I'm Richard, my agent. And it's a lovely story. And in the volume, just called up to say, hey, they've added a part and they want to see you. So I went over and I did this lovely audition. A lot of words, you know. In movies like this, and even like shows like Babylon 5, I get hired for a day, but I have a page and a half of dialogue. It's like being on a soap opera, right? So, yeah. So all these words, and so they hire me. And my agent calls me and he says, "Well, Punch, Stephen wants you for the next film." I said, "Wait a minute, is my agent calling me to offer me a part in Steven Spielberg's next film?" he says, "Yes." So anyway, I turn up on the set, and Chris Walken's first day, Natalie By, Leonardo, in this little room, Lacey Street Studios, because it's a small apartment. And he introduces everybody, and he says, "All right, let's just do a lineup." And I said, "Stephen, one moment, can I just say something before?" He goes, yeah, sure, Alice, what are you?" I go, "Junior, count to 20 in Greek." And he goes, "No." I go, "Yeah." He goes, "In Alamosa?" I go, "Yeah." And he says, "Oh, my God, Alex was Dr. Henry Jones." And he introduces me, you know, like an old friend. And, you know, that's what I'm talking about. When the joy of this business or any business that you're in because you want to succeed, when you get a moment like that, it's not about the work, about who you are, who he is. It's a random moment of commonality. It's a celebration. That is just completely, talk about changing the room. It's a wonderful feeling, mm-hmm. to go through. And so we finished the lineup of the scene, and he says, "Gosh, Alex, I'm sorry. I didn't make the connection. I just liked your audition." And I go, "That's okay, sir. I've seen, you know, I like all your films too." And he was great. And yeah. So much so, another, 6, 7, 8 years go by, and they're casting Tintin, which is this motion capture.
Yeah.
A comedy of a famous Belgian comic, I think, that Peter Jackson was producing. And there were 25 parts in it because it was all motion captures. They cast me. Basically, I'd gone in, whatever. And it was like there was one part left as a stall holder at Covent Garden. I don't even think it made the final cut. But I get a call. You had an offer for Tintin. And like, I'd gone in to see it with wonderful casting director,
Victoria Burroughs. It was just, it kept me alive. And so it was my 50th birthday. And again, I mean, this is an advertisement for my book and the joy between telling these stories. And thank you for indulging me, but I'm on my 50th birthday. And they call me down for the final fitting to get in the frogman suit, which you have to wear for motion capture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working like in 2 days. And they called and said, can you go down to Playa Vista around 6 o'clock? And I go, well, yeah. And it was my 50th birthday. It was January the 30th, 2009. Is that when I was 50? Yeah, I think so. And so I go, yeah, it's my 50th birthday. So I'm taking the family for dinner. I go, well, bring them. So all of a sudden, we're in this basketball court sized set where they've started filming. They're breaking for the day. And it's like no entrance, no visitors. And here's come Alex and his wife and son. And my son's 10 years old at the time. And I do my wardrobe fitting. Peter Jackson walks by. Hello, Alex. Thank you for doing it. It's lovely. Stephen goes by. By this time, we're ready to go. I go, Stephen. He goes, Alex. And immediately, he says, Alex, Indy 3, catch me if you can. Welcome to Tintin. And I say hi. Okay, immediately. And it's like meeting the four-star general at the Pentagon.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. Mean,
everybody else is ready to say, give me your credentials. And all of a sudden, hey, you know, they're all friendly. So I had my son. And naturally, I said, Stephen, can you meet my son? He goes, yeah. Stephen, you know, he's made films. Most of his films, especially early in his career, are kind of like these boys' adventures. And you see the Fablemans, you know why. I mean, he just created these wonderful memory kind of films.
Yes.
Which they captured quite well in that, was it Super 8?
Yep, Super 8.
J.J. Abrams.
Yep.
Yeah, they captured that sort of the love of it quite well. Anyway, she says, yeah, hi, Jack, this is Stephen, hi. And then immediately he says, would you like to come see your dad work on Friday? And he looks up at his assistants and, you know, okay, they're making a note. And he looks at me and he says, is that okay? And I go, well, I'm sure he'd love to come. I'm sure he'd love to come and see you work. And he says, yeah, okay. So on the day of Tintin in this basketball court, being in the volume, doing the little stalwart gag with the Thompson twins who were Nick Frost and Simon Pegg. Jack and Shelley, my lovely wife, are sitting in Video Village right next to Stephen watching the whole day's work as wow. If he's, you know, he was a guest of Stephen's. And it was just absolutely lovely. And those are the things that give me joy, telling it even now.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, and so, you know, a lot of small parts in big movies, Pretty Woman, I suppose, being an exception. Mm-hmm. But they've been filled with big memories, with, you know, there's no such thing as small parts, only small actors. So mm-hmm. I've dipped my toe in, you know, the real kind of quicksilver of big films enough to know I want to do it again. And I got lucky with Jordan Peele when he was casting his film, very similar experience. They don't make films much like that anymore. The DP was the Chris Nolan's DP, Hoyt van Hoytema, his name is. Mm-hmm. You know, you go on a set, with him, and he says, did you make Tenet? You shot Tenet, didn't you? He goes, yes. I go, whoa. Whoa, like F word. He goes, what? I go, well, just like, whoa. He says, yeah. And I go, yeah, my friends are actually telling me that it plays the same way backwards as it would forward. He goes, yeah, I could see that. You know, things like that.
Jeez.
You know, come on.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Annie Potts, and I'm on Screen and Beyond.
And now, Alex, with all the movies you've met and TV shows, I don't want to cut those out,
yeah.
But with all the ones you've done, is there any one particular that you're proudest of?
You know, funnily enough, there's a Hallmark movie, a Christmas movie that, you know, those Hallmark films are a breed of their own, and they're
when they're good, they're like a good episode of The Waltons would be. They're sort of homespun Americana. And there was a film called The Christmas Pageant that we made about 10 years ago with Melissa Gilbert as a New York theater director who kind of needs to leave town because people don't want to work with her anymore. And her agent sends her up to this sort of Brigadoon kind of upstate town to direct The Christmas Pageant. And I was hired to play this sort of, I guess you'd call him kind of a naive but very funny mayor. Hi, I'm Mayor Noah Humphreys. Welcome. And we're very excited to be here. And it was almost like the Ted Knight character in Mary Tyler Moore.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. And that was a bit of a testament to my dad. They even put me in a top hat and tails, which I kind of got the same sort of the look that they had in the Royal Ascot film. And I really enjoyed that job, and it showed so much in the performance, and it was a substantial role that, funnily enough, I think it's some of my best work. It's called The Christmas Pageant. It's a Hallmark movie. It's just a really, it's a nice light comedy performance.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, you know, mainstream, I don't think you can do better than Pretty Woman. I had enough scenes and enough story arc in Pretty Woman to make a difference, and that was very fulfilling.
Yeah.
And then playing a fighter pilot on the Kennedy and Super Carrier was just a great job. But I would say that I did a little scene in the Dahmer, Jeffrey Dahmer movie. I played a doctor, a baby doctor early on. It was a good scene.
Hmm.
That was fun a couple of years ago.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that I ask this question a lot to different actors, and there's, you know, automatically you think that they're going to say the blockbusters that they were in, but a lot of times it's some nice little movie that they made that they like the best and say that, you know, I think this was one of my best performances. It wasn't necessarily the one that everybody knows you for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a nice question, and it's a sort of a litmus test, of personality. The most satisfied accomplishment I've had in my career, full stop, is creating, putting together, casting, producing, and editing I call it a fantasy documentary called 3 Days of Hamlet that really scratched this lifelong itch of mine, having left England as a youngster, never really gone through the English acting sort of world. I so liked the words and the music of Shakespeare and never really been able, I mean, I did. I played Romeo as a kid on a Showtime for TV with Blanche Baker. So I'd had experience, but I put together this project of Hamlet to do as a staged reading over 3 days. And it ended up being half reality, half play, and it was I call it a fantasy documentary. It's sort of like Big Brother, the CBS show, like Big Brother meets, you know, meets traveling players. And I had Richard Chamberlain as Polonius, Stephanie Powers was Gertrude, and Peter Woodward, Edward's son, as Laertes. And I green screened myself as the ghost a couple of weeks prior. And so I played back on the green screen, me doing the ghost, saying, "Hamlet, you can remember me," all this stuff. And here I was, clean shaven and looking trim and fit and sort of acting with myself and this troupe of players. It's an extraordinary project. And that was a labor of love that remains, I suppose, my opus, because it was almost... It was matched several years later when I wrote the book, because I felt that I created it. I made it happen.
Yep.
And to going back to your original question, being the son of anything, Ted Turner's father started an advertising business, but Ted Turner turned it into Turner Network. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
And I was able to take what my father had given me, whether he meant to or not. He was probably hoping that I wouldn't try because he knows how difficult and often tragic it can be. But I was able to create something that people told me, and we had a UCLA humanities professor named Michael Allen, who just passed away at age 82 earlier this year. He was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. He must have influenced so many people. He told me, he called me the next day, he said, Punch, my middle name, friends call me that. Punch, you've done something completely your own. You've created your own Hamlet. And, you know, you would say that to Gerald de Maurier in 1910 or John Barrymore or right. Laurence Olivier. And that's something that just meant a lot to me and still does.
Yeah.
It's out there. You can get out. It's out there on DVD, you know.
Yeah.
It was an incredible project.
Huh. Well, Alex, we're going to finish up, but before I ask the final questions that I usually ask, I have to ask you a question because I got an email from a couple of listeners, actually, who found out that I was going to have you on the show. And they said, if you don't ask this question, we will never listen to your show again. So,
oh, don't do that.
Okay. So,
at least they said they're wanting you to ask it. They're not necessarily need me to answer it.
Right.
So that's good.
That's true. But they wanted me to ask about a film that you made, but officially was never released, and you called the Fantastic Four. You were Mr. Fantastic, right? Richards.
Reed Richards, the original, the OG, yeah, the original Reed. Absolutely, yeah.
So can you give us an idea of what went on there just to, you know, just to please my listeners?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's a well-known story, and, you know, there's an awful lot of fans of it because, you know, Marvel, quite rightly, has created this this tentpole, huge space where all of these movies are fan favorites, and some of them are more liked than others. It just so happens that the big Fantastic Fours are not well liked. And so you look back at our original Fantastic Four, and, you know, it was supposed to be creaky. It was supposed to be kind of silly. And we went at that in the full knowledge that even if it was never going to be seen, that we were going to enjoy it and we were going to take it seriously. And the story about that film being I guess you would call it a rights play. The film was made because it was a contractual obligation by the German producers or the German rights holders. They had to be in production by a certain date. I think it was December 30th, whenever, 1992, maybe. So November 28th, we start rolling.
Wow.
And, you know, they cast me. I've done a couple of Roger Corman films. And I went in one meeting, and my friend Ole Sassone, who's the director, he lives in New Orleans. I'm now living in Pensacola, Florida, so I see him quite often, a couple times a year. Go in, and it's one of those instances that I've loved, and I write about in the book, how if you can go in one meeting, and the people who are hiring, if you solve their problem, there's no need for a callback. There's no need for anything. And the trouble with the writer-driven TV shows these days is they can't. It's so difficult to get a part because there's so many cooks in the kitchen. That's the joy of independent film, or in Pretty Woman's case, they were filming. They needed to cast the part. If you are right and you are in a room, or you're going to be on a set with people who are good at their job, then they don't make you feel like you're lucky to get it. They feel like they're lucky to have you. And when that's how Reed Richards came to me. So naturally, my allegiance was to this film.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger's a great producer because he rewards initiative. What you wouldn't make from him is you know, you make some money, but I mean, it's not a well paying job. But funnily enough, the original Fantastic Four is one of the first things that people ask me about, because it's such a rare and unique story about a project that really deserves to be remembered, not in the conventional sense, in a far more glorified sense, because there's nothing quite like it. If this film had been released conventionally in 1994 with its infantile special effects, it would have been forgotten and dismissed, like the Punisher films or early Captain America films, or even Battlestar Galactica, the original, which was a big budget, you know. But it hasn't. It still lives on. And it has a memory for much of the audience. And the audience respects that memory. It doesn't matter whether it's that good or not. It's the audience's memory is real. And
I do sometimes. I'm back into the world of appearances and conventions a couple times a year. I go and I sell my books. They want to buy my book. They want to have pictures with me, and it's absolutely lovely. Again, I'm not a famous. I'm not a product. I'm not a famous Hollywood product. I'm a fella who grew up in one part of the business, got into another part, and made my way, and I'm still doing it, and I have stories to tell, and none of them are better or more well received than Tell Me About the Fantastic Four. So thank you to your listeners. Yeah. Keep listening to this show.
Yeah, and you know, but it just amazes me that a movie that has never been released,
yeah,
is so enjoyed. I mean, people love it, and it's surprising. You know, how are they getting it? That's what makes me wonder.
Well, it's easy now. I mean, it's been on the internet forever.
Yeah,
The wonderful thing that span of my life is that I started in the last of sort of the old Hollywood system, contracts and three networks and five movie studios, and I've been at it long enough, and I still haven't found anything better to do, and. I haven't struck it rich, but I've been rich in spirit and rich in experience that I'm now still part and thriving. And as soon as we can end this stupid actor's strike, we can get back to work. Mm. And I'm working in the medium, which is completely digital now. My audiobooks are read off a Kindle, and they're downloaded of MP3. There's no paper. There's no, in film, unless you're Hoyt Van Hoytema and Jordan Peele, you don't shoot your movies on film. You shoot it on video, much to my dismay, because they usually look pretty flat and awful. But I know what it is to work in the analog way, technically. And still, when you're storytelling or when you're acting or you're playing music at a club or a pub, that is person to person. That is actor to audience. That's comedian to drink minimum. That's real in the moment. And I'm glad that I know what that should be like. I think it's the advent of celebrity and sort of instant fame now. It's taken the edge. It's taken the it's detracted from what I euphemistically would say the art of acting. It's not so much an art anymore. It's a lot of times it's been more of a commodity. And I think the Fantastic Four is an example of a franchise suffering because of that way of thinking.
Yeah. Well, Alex, we're going to finish up with the one or two final questions, depending on how you feel about, you know, the number. But the question is, when you sit back and relax, what are your favorite TV shows now and of the past? And what's your favorite movies now and of the past? What do you enjoy?
The Great Escape was one of my 50-cent Saturday matinee favorites.
Classic film.
Camelot in Palm Springs. Yeah, loved it. Of course, The Godfather and Star Wars, and as a mid to late 70s, those are, when I saw those films, I was probably a bit young to see The Godfather, but certainly by the time Star Wars came around, I knew I wanted to fly jets in space. It was just the fantasy aspect, very influential. Yeah. 1990s Michael Mann film with Daniel Day-Lewis of Last of the Mohicans, I think still is one of the greatest adventure movies of the modern era. Harrison Ford in Patriot Games was another big favorite of mine. I like the Irish aspect to it, the melody. I really liked Terrence Malick's film Tree of Life several years ago. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. TV shows... Happy Days, All in the Family. Hill Street Blues was my favorite show. And when on my 25th birthday, my William Morris agent in L.A. called to say that they liked me in an audition, and they offered me two episodes of Hill Street Blues. Mm-hmm. That was an example of the fan getting a reward, because I was a huge fan of the show.
Yeah.
So many, and I was in that show. And that's happened a couple of other times. The Mentalist, when that was on, I really enjoyed that show, and then I got an episode of it, and I felt like it was, you know, I knew how to act in that show because I was a great fan. Hmm. These days, you know, what did we like? On TV, what's
You know, we've been watching this lovely, we call it Happy Valley, this Virgin River.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And the great Tim Matheson is in it.
Tim's been a guest here. He's been my guest.
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah, no, he's lovely. I worked with him in an episode of This Is Us that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
I like adventures. I liked The English. That was a show, I think, on Netflix. Was a very good a Western with an English actress who created it. Was a show. But I'm always open to suggestions. So I'm easy to find, alexhydewhite.com. And please, sorry to bore your listeners, but send me some ideas for TV shows. I've run out of my queue.
Well, Alex, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to share with us. And people should go out and get your book on Amazon. And is there any place they can get an autograph copy? Do you ever?
Yeah, you know, I'm easy to find online. I have a personal actor website, and then our audiobook company is Punch Audio, has a website. And all roads lead to Rome. So send us a message. I'd be happy to send you a book at list price, and I'm happy to sign it. If you're a Fantastic Four fan, there's some pictures I can enclose. Yeah, I'm the store is open at wholesale prices. I'm happy to, you know, give. If people want to know about me and are willing, like you, to indulge me in these long meandering answers that occasionally I will land back where we started, then I'm happy to accommodate.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Alex. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Thank you. And thank you to your listeners. Keep up the good work.
And a big thank you going out to Alex Hyde-White for joining us here at On Screen and Beyond. And it's, so interesting to hear his story. And we hope you enjoyed that one. If you have a suggestion for a guest or want to tell me what you thought of a different episode, you can email me at feedback@onscreenandbeyond.com. And I'd love to hear from you. Or you can, leave something on the socials. Try to get to those too. And if you have a suggestion or if you have a connection with somebody who was in a show, send it to me and we'll see if we can get that person on. So anyways, we've got the holidays coming up. So I'm not sure if we'll have an episode next week or a few days later, whatever. We'll see what we can do. And then after that, we'll keep coming your way right here on Screen and Beyond. So keep listening to On Screen and Beyond. Be sure to go to onscreenandbeyond.com and look at all the things that we have done over the years, all the people who have given us their fascinating stories, and I hope you'll check them all out, download them all, tell a friend about On Screen and Beyond, get the word out, love, getting more and more people listening to On Screen and Beyond. So I hope you'll do that for us. Best thing to do is to subscribe. Now, it doesn't cost anything. It's not one of those subscription things where you got to pay and all that. It's just wherever you're getting your podcast. They may call it following, some of them now. So, anyways, what happens is as soon as I release the episode, you will get it downloaded to your computer, phone, whatever you're listening on. And that's just the easiest way to do it. You don't have to keep going looking for it and all that. So just follow us, like us, whatever they call it, subscribing, whatever. Just do it, and it'll make it easier for you. So we've got a lot more guests coming your way. That's it. That's the end of another episode. That's a wrap for this episode of On Screen and Beyond. So until next time, when we once again take you on screen and beyond, I'm Brian Zemirak. Take care.